This is HBR episode 2806 entitled HBR Community News for April 2019 and is part of the series HBR Community News. It is hosted by HBR volunteers and is about 114 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is HBR volunteers talk about shows released and comments posted in April 2019.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and welcome to another edition of Hacker Public Radio. Joining me tonight is, from top to bottom...
Hello, it's Dave Morris.
Hello, it's Yannick de French from Switzerland.
Hi. I'm sorry, it's quite difficult to make the mental change from to be a happy bunny from just observing a minute's silence for the Dutch Remembrance Day is there now, so, and happens to coincide with the 8 o'clock kickoff of HBR. So in a rather somber note, we'll start off saying that this is the HBR Community News for 2019, and HBR is a community podcast network where shows are submitted by listeners just like you. In fact, very much like you. In fact, yes, you could send in a show and become a podcaster. And this is the community news show, which is put on by HBR volunteers, or just random people who decide to join the mumble server. The first Monday, the Saturday before the first Monday of the month at 6 o'clock, 1800 UTC on Mumble. So, did we have any new hosts this month, Dave?
We did not have any new hosts this month.
Shame, no. Shame, for shame. I'll cry a little tear. Anyway, how was your previous month? Let's do the banter section.
Well, mine was mine's good. I seem to have resigned somewhere or other in some parallel universe, but luckily we fell into this universe, so it's all okay.
Yeah.
Don't know how that
Sorry
happened.
About that.
Strange what happens when you're not around.
You miss one day, Dave, then what happens?
Yeah.
Yannick?
Well, this month was cool. Not a lot happened, except that I broke my 3D printer, so it's currently not working. I'm waiting for replacement parts. And yeah, that's... I did record three, four episodes for HBR. So when I was published this month, one is next month, and then I still got two that I need to submit and schedule.
Excellent.
So busy month.
Cool. And I finally got to start thinking about new website redesign and stuff like that more anon. And I've just come back from a two-week visit to my in-laws in Ireland. So, yes. Anyway, this show that you're listening to now is an opportunity for us to make sure that every show gets a mention since last month. And the first show in the roundup is 2781, which was HBR Community News for March 2019. Oddly enough, this was not filed under the Community News. It was filed under April Fool's section. But it didn't have any comments, so nobody cared about that show. The next day we had Never Stop Gaming, Ways to Feed the Game Impulse Even When You Can't Game. And without even looking at the host, I guessed correctly that it was Klaatu.
Yep. Go ahead.
No, fire ahead.
No, I was going to say that it's an interesting take on the game, well, I was going to say the gaming universe, but that's not the, what I'm looking for. But the way to not just say, okay, we're going to play from this time to this time on that particular day. It's a continuous thing. And I remember when I was doing role-playing game, I was constantly reading stuff and building characters and building scenarios and campaigns. And I think he depicted this very well in this episode. It's I would say it's kind of a way of life and not just a hobby.
So I think the premise of the show was that between RPG games, your character goes off and does other things. So it's not just like in Minecraft when the character is away, it just stands there. It's you're busy doing other things and you can come back and then you have more experience and stuff. So yeah, go ahead, Dave.
No, I was just going to say that I thought Yannick's summary was actually very good. I struggled to write notes to myself to explain what went on here, but yeah, it was interesting to listen to. But I guess because it's a mindset that I don't have. I find myself not being a gamer, and somehow or other being away, locked out of it all somehow. I don't understand it, but. There you go. That's just me.
I think I'm just afraid of this exact thing that I will be compulsively doing it in between sessions.
Yeah, that's a risk. Well, I was playing when I was a student, so I had time.
Oh, yeah, fine. One thing, Dave, though, about this is the link to the show notes is a link to somebody's blog, which is an excellent blog, don't get me wrong, but... As you know, how do you deal with that on Internet Archive?
Well, it's the notes are as they stand, and it is a thing that bothers me slightly as well, because it means that if that link ever deteriorates or goes away, then we're stuck. What I've tended to do in the past shows where that's happened, and I've found them, and I don't have a process of doing it yet, is to go and fish around, see if I can find the site that's now gone away and on the Wayback Machine, and then either link to what I find there, or in some cases gather up what was there and put it into the show if it's pictures or something like that. So it's a difficult one. Part of the reason I was a bit silent here was because I was gazing at these notes thinking, wow, I'm sure that the notes behind these notes are great, but I can't remember reading them. I'm sure I did actually. I have looked on MixSignals and there's some great stuff there, but it means that we're sort of left high and dry if anything happens.
Yeah, my temptation would be to go to the website, download the text and the images, and store it locally. More to be thinking about this. I've had this as well with my own shows where I put on, where I've edited them on my own blog, and then basically copied the HTML across, and there's not an elegance to it. So,
It's a problem. It's the issue of archiving, really, isn't it?
The whole
business of archiving is a difficult one, and you need to have some sort of a strategy and a plan and an agreement as to how you do this, because maybe people don't want stuff to be archived in some form, but the fact that they've put a pointer to it in an HBR show which is being archived implies that they do. But it's something that needs to be thrashed out a bit more in a bit more of a public forum, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's CC by SA, so it's compatible with the license, so we can just take it. And of course, it's Cavalcade Audio and Slacker Media, yeah? So it's there's no question there. That's why I'm comfortable discussing it with Tlatu's, Tlatu and Lost in Bronx's material. Even Lost in Bronx just throws the stuff away, literally. In a good way. Don't mean that negatively at all. He just gives it away and encourages people to do so. Because I'm going back specifically related to one of the topics that we have at the end of the show about archiving, and it's difficult to get shows to get context for even some of the early HBR shows, let alone the Today with a Techie stuff, let alone Freaknik, let alone Bin Rev Radio, etc. You know. Yes.
These things sort of deteriorate quite in an upsetting way over time. A personal anecdote: I'm thinking of doing another show on how I got to computers, having started many, many years ago. And I started looking for information about stuff from the 1970s. And wow, there's so much that's gone. So much has disappeared completely. And it's so disappointing to find it. So I'm a strong advocate of archiving whenever possible.
And this is actually what I was doing this month. For some reason, I was able to get my head together and, you know, started thinking about HBR and how we move forward, and actually writing some text down, drawing some diagrams, etc., and erasing them and throwing it all away again and just starting again. And basically, the idea would be to have everything available as an, you know, either an rsync that you could, people could rsync it down, or git pull it down, or FTP it down, or mirror the website, so that everything is a physical unit. You have a show, and in that show you have a show note. Pretty much what you're doing, Dave, on your shows, you have a small index.html, which if it's enough, then there's no need to have more detailed one. And if there's a more detailed one, then there's the full show notes following the convention. And then, you know, every day you do an rsync of HPR and the whole lot, the new shows come down. Everything else is anything that's been updated. So the RSS feeds will be updated. The series for whatever series that happened to be in gets updated. And what else would get updated? The main page, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But in that way, then, we have the internet as our rsync server. So, you know, anybody who wants to rsync against us, then they have a copy of all the HBR stuff as an individual unit. So you can take that entire episode, and you've got all the show notes, you've got all the audio, you've got, you know, if there's video, you've got everything there. And that's where I am at the minute. Okay, sorry, a little bit of a tangent there. Why? Maybe it's just you and I, Dave, that finds this interesting.
No. Yeah, I was listening very carefully.
And what I actually want to be able to do is that when people pull that down, that if they put a web server, or if they open it up in a browser, like in Dolphin or Windows File Manager or something, that they can navigate the static site locally. But if you put it behind any form of a simple website, web server, then you can serve a mirror of HPR. You know, back in the old days, there used to be mirrored networks around the place. It was a thing, and it stopped being a thing. And that one of the shows this month will talk about the heydays of podcasting. So let's pause until that point.
Yeah. Okay.
Meanwhile, back to the plot. The Windows shutdown.exe command explained by Claudio Miranda. Didn't even know this existed. Awesome.
Yeah, didn't know it existed either.
No, me neither.
But who's using the command line on Windows anyway?
Lots of people, actually. That's how I got started on the command line, was doing command line stuff in Windows. Well, doing command line stuff in DOS, and then Windows came along and all those commands still worked. So, Bubba says, shutdown command. Thanks for the insight. There's a scheduled power outage at work next month, and with this, I can make sure everybody's workstation is shut down properly without running around looking at the lights. My friends, that right there gives this show a reason to exist.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Of interest to hackers, plural, meaning two people.
Yeah. Claude UM replies, also useful with PS exec from sysinternal suite. Glad you found it useful. While you can use it alone, it's also useful with tools like PS exec from the sysinternal suite. I might do an episode about that particular command as well. That suite has so many tools, but PS exec is the one I use the most. And he gives a link. You could probably create a batch file or PowerShell script to go through a list of host names and have them reboot or shut down remotely.
Claudio, please do a episode on PS exec. It is a phenomenal set of tools, and you are literally beating your head against a wall on Windows machines until you have that stuff installed. It is a brilliant set of tools. So please, love to hear more shows about that.
So he now owes you a show.
Did he say that he was going to? I might record. Is that enough to say?
Yeah, it's enough.
Okay. Okay, fair enough, yeah. The Yamaha Disc Lavier. Criticize my pronunciation, Dave.
Well, no, I would pronounce it that way because I fall naturally to the French way of saying it. But Disc Lavier is the more German way of saying it, which is where it comes from, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Where John Culp talks about his Yamaha Disc Lavier DKC500RW that's in my office at work, or in his office at work. Basically, this is a player piano. John. I'm not even going to... I'll let you comment on this so I can pretend I didn't hear the music that he used as examples.
Yeah, but it was not too long. No, it was very short.
Fair music. Use, I guess.
Yeah, fair use. Yeah. I would say so too.
okay.
But despite using copyrighted music, it was really interesting, and the sound quality of this piano is amazing. I mean, he did play a track that he rewrote. And I'm not really into that kind of music, but it was really, really nice, and it sounds like a very interesting piece of machinery, this clavier.
What blew my mind was the recordings of actual pianists actually playing the work. Can you imagine if this existed in Mozart's time, the number of debates that would be on nighttime BBC TV would just diminish. No, you're completely wrong. Here it is. Here's him playing it. Oh, right. You're right. Well, sorry about that. We'll move on to our next piece.
Yeah.
Anyone want to do the old comments there?
So, shall I start? Turto says, music to ears. Music to ears, literally. That Disc Clavier must be really high tech because it can replicate playing so well. And watching the video of Disc Clavier playing was a really nice bonus. This reminded me of time when, as a wee lad, I made a trip to a museum of mechanical music, and they had completely mechanical piano that could play different dynamics, flourishes, and whatnot.
And Jan responded, translations. Hello, folks. Diskette is the German word for floppy disk. Klavier is the German word for piano. Tastatur is the German word for keyboard, at least in terms of computers. A piano's keyboard would be called Klaviatur. So this clavier can be split into diskette and clavier. Thanks for the fine show.
Excellent. John says, okay, but it wasn't the well-tempered piano. But remember, in 1722, Bach wrote Das, oh my God, Klavier. And at the time, the piano as an instrument did not exist. It had to mean either keyboard, harpsichord, or clavichord. Keyboard is most generic.
Does somebody else want to do the next one, and I'll do mine after.
Fair enough.
So, Gertrus responded, so cool. I'm not by far music literate, but the technology in this is so mesmerizing. I'm wondering if the tech exists for other types of instruments, i.e. wind and percussion.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. So I said, what a wonderful device. Hi, John. I love this. It's a magnificent instrument. I never knew there was anything quite so sophisticated. I watched the Music Machine Mondays on the Wintergarten YouTube channel a couple of years ago. They visited the Spielklok Museum in Utrecht and looked at the marvels there. And I refer to a playlist of all of the visits. But this disc clavier is a significant evolution of these machines. Listening to your show, I was reminded of a thing I liked to listen to when I was a kid, Sparky's Magic Piano. There's a link in Wikipedia. It was often on the radio on Saturdays on a children's music program. It was probably in the 1950s. I was slightly puzzled by the pronunciation of disc clavier, thinking it should be pronounced the French way. A bit of Googling proved me wrong, and you're right, of course. In my defense, I used to live in an area of rural England with many villages named after Norman French families, which were pronounced strangely, at least to my ears. My favorite was a place called Little Haute-Bois, as I would say in the French form, not very far away, an easy cycle ride away from home, and it was called by the locals Hobbis. And there's a link to that as well. So pronunciation's always been a thing, as far as I'm concerned.
And what do you mean exactly? What do you mean exactly by strangely pronounced French words?
Well, Hobbis is not how you would say haute bois, which meant high wood,
Au-bois.
Didn't?
Yeah.
Au-bois, Au-bois. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. My French pronunciation ain't that good, but
no, I'm just picking on you.
my level of French is schoolboy French, where we probably would have said that. And everybody in French books that we read lived on Rue Barbe, which was a British joke, of course, because it sounds like rhubarb,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. You know, so just to give you some idea of the level.
And it's Spielklok Museum. If Jeroen was here, he would be very disappointed.
Did I not say that?
Nope.
What did I say? Spielklok.
Oh. Anyway. Guy says, how far away are you? You said you could listen over the internet no matter how many hundreds of thousands of miles away you are. What moon or planet would that be? Sorry, couldn't resist. It was an interesting show. Thanks.
And John responded, or not off, referring to this this comment, I guess. Oops, I thought I said hundreds or thousands, not hundreds of thousands.
Windigo says, Library of Congress. First of all, this has been one of my favorite shows of all time. What a fascinating musical instrument, not to mention a cool piece of technology. But then you drop this in nonchalantly. I was working at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. one summer, .. Dude, it's possible that you've covered this elsewhere, but I listened to a whole show about that, how that happened. It's always great to hear from you.
And John replied, a great summer job. Hi, Windigo. Thanks for the comment. Yes, I did work at the Library of Congress in the summer of 1993 as a junior fellow, a paid internship, which was quite prestigious. I didn't know if they still have this or not. I don't know if they still have this or not. It was an amazing gig for musicology nerd to get to work in the music division, helping to process the recently acquired archive of Arnold Copland. Maybe this is worth an episode of its own. Does that owe me a show as well?
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm winning today.
And John also said, "Older near perfect player pianos." Dave, sorry it took me so long to respond to your very thoughtful comment. I appreciate the link to the Self-Playing Instruments video podcast. There are some really good ones in there. I'm especially impressed by the Self-Playing Steinway Duo Art Piano, recorded by Sergei Prokofiev. That one is nearly as faithful to the actual playback as the Yamaha disc clavier, but is limited by the length of the paper that is recorded on. It's an analog equivalent, incredibly accurate in its reproduction. There were earlier ones, too. That whole phenomenon would merit an entire series, but I don't know that much about it. Ha ha.
Well,
I guess he owes us a series now.
Yeah, you could at least start it. Oh, you see what happens here. You send in a show, and then you ask more shows. Ah, well, that's the way it goes. What is UCPE? A short talk on the telco networking standards, and this is on JWP, about network foundation virtualization, universal customer premises equipment.
Well, you seem to know a lot more than me on the subject.
Yeah, I looked at some of the links because I think John had forgotten to give any tags, so those are mine.
Okay, yeah.
So it was just me reiterating some of the keywords that I saw there. But yeah, I didn't come away a lot more knowledgeable from it. Didn't spend a lot of time though.
Yeah, I've some. I actually intended on my holidays to talk to somebody in the know about this, somebody in the know being my brother, but he refused to talk to me on his holidays. He didn't want to talk about work while he was on his holidays. So
fair enough.
I will get to that again. Universal CPE. I get the concept, but I don't know the blurb that we have. What is universal CPE? It's got a lot of buzzwords in it, but it doesn't actually tell you what it is. It consists of a software virtual network functions running on a standard operating system hosted on an open server. The ideal UCP deployment supports a multi-tier, multi-component configuration. As such, UCP brings the power of the cloud to telco network in its gateway to innovations. And that's all very well, but why would you put a customer premises equipment, by definition, it's customer premises equipment, why would you put that into the cloud? So, are they sort of running an individual Docker container for each of the customers and then rendering all the video and sending it back down to the... So what's the point? I understand that you can do it. It might be useful for testing, working in... Basically, my day job is TV. I can see how that would be useful, but it kind of defeats the purpose. So more information to come, guys. The following day, my YouTube channels, inspired by Ahuka, Tony Hughes, sends in his shows, including Big Clive, Category 5, Computer Explained, DOS Geek, Big Daddy Linux, Raspberry Pi, and free Audacity tutorials. All of these are very good, and I have been at all of them before. Big Clive, of course, I watch religiously.
I know most of them, but I don't really follow them, as in I'm not subscribed to them, but yeah, I've watched at least once.
Yeah, I've watched a fair number of them as well. Some of them are on my must watch list, but not all. Some interesting pointers I didn't know about. Didn't know about the Audacity tutorials. That could be fun.
Yeah, that could be useful. Yeah, especially here. Sorry, go ahead, Orc.
No, I was just gonna say that I actually appeared on Big Daddy Linux a few times.
Did you now?
Yep.
So the following day we had Node.js part 1. I don't know JavaScript do.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's the way it arrived, so I didn't.
Is somebody trolling me, Dave?
I think somebody forgot the word in that thing. Yes. I completely forgot to ask him what he'd missed out, to be honest.
Yep. Strange title, but hey, it's a title.
It's eye-catching. It's got us.
Yeah.
Turutoto says, looking for more. Great start to a series. I love learning how people are learning new skills like programming languages. And this is very good one to be learning Node.js. It's kind of popular at the minute.
Yeah, yeah. Node.js is the the JavaScript interpreter. So technically Node.js is not a language. JavaScript is the language, but it's like Java and the JVM. The JVM is Node.js is the equivalent of the JVM, and Java is the, well, JavaScript is the language. And then, yeah, and Node.js is really interesting in that when you know how to write JavaScript for the browser, then you don't really have to learn anything more to write backend programs. So that's great.
I thought this was a great premise for a series, actually, especially since he says he's obviously a very skilled guy because he knows a lot about all sorts of stuff, but he's not, I think he said something to the effect that he's not, he doesn't see himself as a programmer as such. And I thought that was a great voyage that he set himself on, and I was fascinated to hear how he gets on with it, you know. I don't think it, am I right? He said, I didn't make a note of it, unfortunately, something like he hasn't had any formal programming tuition.
At least in JavaScript. I don't remember if this was
misinterpreted. I hope I didn't, but yeah. But still, I'd be fascinated to follow along with his exploration of this thing.
Well, this is titled Node.js Part 1, so part 2 is to be expected.
Absolutely. You want Part 2, please. Yes.
On this show, moving on. Looping in Haskell to the total is describing how to do loop-like constructs in Haskell. And it was interesting to find out that they don't really exist. You need to do recursion in order to do loops.
Yeah.
Kind
of, it's kind of I think it's a threat of functional languages. I don't recall that Scala has any looping structure either. When I listened to this, I remembered my days when I was learning Scala. So yeah, you need to map, you need to fold your lists. It's interesting to see that pretty much all functional languages work the same. So basically, a for loop or while loop is really a procedural thing.
Weird.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, because things like map is an iterator. In as much as it is applying a thing to a list repeatedly by some magic means that you don't necessarily know about. Having been an assembly level programmer when I first started working in IT, I find myself always wanting to understand what the underlying processes, and you sort of imagine that these things map onto a bit of iterative looping in assembler. But I don't know if that's a good insight or not. Actually, sometimes not, probably.
It really depends on the what you have to do and the language. But Java recently added those things that is. They call that the Stream API. Well, it's it's really interesting, but you know, it's like everything, you've got to be really careful not to make your program more complex by using things that you think will make it less complex. I don't know if that makes any sense, but those maps are let's take the map function, for example. It's really elegant. But then when you chain that with other functional stuff, then it can be really hard to read the program. But you can do awesome stuff in like one line of code.
Yeah. I being a bit of a Perl fan, there's all sorts of things that do something vaguely equivalent to it, where you can process lists with a map command and so forth. And I have been I have ended up writing stuff where there are lots of those sorts of things chained together, because at the time you write it, you think, oh yeah, just add another one in and another one in, and you come back to look at it later on, or you hand it to somebody else and they go, what is this?
yeah exactly.
I've had phone calls from having retired saying, you know that script you wrote, what the hell is that supposed to be doing? And So not always wise. You're very right. Yeah, very. Absolutely agree.
Yes. I think I've struggled with the map function in some of the scripts you've sent me, Dave.
Oh, no.
You know all about it because you explained it to me, so that's fine. So the following day, we had pacing and storytelling. Lost in Bronx takes a stab at explaining why pacing in your story really matters.
Yeah, as usual, really interesting, even though I'm not into this storytelling subject, but yeah, still very interesting to listen to.
Shall I do the comments? To Toto says, what about non-fictional stories? I love listening to this series and started wondering how applicable and or easy would it be to adapt these topics in a non-fictional story that isn't a story at all. If there's a book that teaches readers about programming, can some of these topics still be relevant? Could a study book build towards some climatic revelation that is hinted more and more as it comes closer and then revealed in all its glory?
I've seen that attempted a few times, and it would be great if it could, but it's also, if it, the counter to that is if the story isn't engaging or not of interest to people, the students, for example, it can put you off because, for example, sometimes when you're doing a, in the last Python programming course I did, the example was computer gaming, and I had no interest in it, and half the class had no interest in it, the other half did. And for half the class, it was great, and they were really enjoying it, but for the rest of us, we were really struggling because we had no idea of these concepts, and not having played multi the games that he was designing, it was of no relevance to us. So, but then again, a regular story, it would be interesting. I'd love to hear Lost in Bronx view on this, actually.
Yeah, me too, actually. It would be an interesting approach, and somebody with the skills to do it, talking about it, would be most intriguing.
Now you know how to record your next episode about Bash.
It was a dark night.
The secret. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm thinking now.
Knowing Tattoo, he's already hidden encrypted messages in all his previous shows, and there's some person going out there. Yes, I've cracked his code. Sorry, carry on. Hello.
I think I'm. Can you hear me? Because I.
Yeah.
My.
I can hear you. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I thought my button was stuck. It's okay. I hadn't anything else to say.
Next series of Bash. Yes, that would have been good. Okay, the following day we had YouTube subscriptions part 5 from Mahuka, Mental Floss, Minute Earth, Minute Physics, Mona Lisa Twins, Monty Python, Objectivity, Official Go or Being, PBS, EOS, Eons, PBS, Space Time, Periodic Values, Physics Girl, Roll On TV, RV, Education 101, RV to Freedom, Scientium, Science Friday, SciShow, Fizz. So, I now understand why the ordering of them seems so random to me. He's doing them in alphabetical order.
Yes. yes, well done.
Yes.
Actually, PBS Eons is one of my favorites. I love that. It's really, really well done. A little bit too short and a little bit too polished for my tastes. They could get the point quicker, but still, it's got some amazing stuff in it.
Yeah, I've really started going away from shows that have really quick cuts in it. It seems to me to be defeating the purpose of a YouTube video, you know, grabbing your attention and shoving it in your face. Look, give me 4 hours of Big Clive's hands just taking something apart. It's fine.
I was saying this to my kids who when I make utterances like this, usually sort of back away and go, oh God, he's doing it again. But saying that some of the way they cut these things, there's a sort of image about vaguely about the subject.
and then they keep showing it over and over and over and over again. The other thing they do, and that's so irritating, the other thing they do is they do a full shot of the presenter, then they zoom in, and then they zoom right in as if somebody has grabbed your head and shoved it at their face so hard that you want to pull away. And one who has quite a large personal space, I find that to be really disturbing. Why must you do this, you know? But they think I'm nuts and probably
no, I completely
don't like it.
If the content should stand by itself, and there are plenty of other YouTubers out there who can do it. Smarter Every Day, for instance, he just looks into the camera, kind of interesting. And then you'll cut to a diagram, and then he comes back and talks to you about it. Well, I get what's going on. Anyway, sorry, yes. It's just, I find it sad that I unsubscribe from some channels because the content is good, but I just can't look at them.
Yeah. I haven't quite reached that point yet, because PBS Eons, for example, contains a lot of really good information about paleontology that I find fascinating. But the presentation really hasn't quite got to the point of grating so much that I want to stop, but it might do.
Okay, folks, and if you have podcast or YouTube recommendations, please contribute to this episode. If you've got podcast recommendations, I'd also like to hear. The following day, we have Looks Like True Crypts. Oh, I see what he did there. Do you see that? Looks Like True Crypt, LUCKS, Linux, what is this? Linux Crypto File System? And what the U stands for. Tattoo demonstrates how to use LVM and crypt setup to create and use portable encrypted file systems. Now, what I would like Tattoo to do for me is, and this is a show I've been trying to put together myself, where in theory it could be possible. Say you have two Raspberry Pis, right? You with me so far?
Only two?
No, you've got two Raspberry Pis, yeah? They're both identical, two people either side of the world. One person in, let's say, the Netherlands, buys one, and one person, let's say, in pick a random country, New Zealand, buys one, right? Two identical Raspberry Pis, yeah. And you've got download a default Raspbian image on both of the Pis. Now, the person in the Netherlands knows the root password for their Pi, and the person in New Zealand knows the completely different root password for their Pi. Would there be a way to connect in a... So both of them do a backup with their, both of them buy a, I don't know, 5 terabyte drive, right? And they encrypt it with Lux and they ship it to the other person. Okay, it's now encrypted. It's now encrypted on the other side. Would there be a way to mount that disk? So the Dutch disk is now in New Zealand and the New Zealand disk is now in the Netherlands. Would there be a way to mount that disk securely through the other Raspberry Pi without the person being able to decrypt it in transit? I'm sure.
Wow.
My good feeling is it should be possible to mount the remote disk on your PC. So if I was here in the Netherlands, I should be able to connect to the other disk over there via SSH, and then mount over SSHFS the encrypted disk, sent so that the Lux file system will be decrypted on this side. I don't know if even that's possible, or I'm going to be nuts. If somebody has an idea on this, I'd really love to hear a show about this. And I'm happy to work on this particular one as well, because I think this is actually a good way to keep backups of your stuff around the place, because once you did the initial transfer, then the rest is just rsynced across, and you can set your disk to time out once your rsyncing is done. So it just comes on once a day, copies in your data, trickles it in, and then shuts the disk off. But what I'd like to be able to do is prevent the other person from ever being exposed to the data. Not that I don't necessarily trust the other person, but so the other person doesn't need to worry about law enforcement officials or whatever, whereby they can say, I genuinely do not have the access to this. You can take the disk. I have no problem with that. I don't have any information that will allow you to decrypt this, because there's no way that I can do it. And even if law enforcement, not suggesting that we're doing anything illegal here, is just, could you do that for the whole concept of offsite backups?
Yeah, probably, but then you would have to expose the...
Yeah, but there's got to be a way.
There's got to be a way. Yeah.
Can you mount the Lux device back so that the ones and zeros, the encrypted ones and zeros, are sent back over the wire locally to another, say, Raspberry Pi in the Netherlands, and you hide that transport bit in the middle? It's got to be possible. Anyway, somebody with more time on their hands.
You'd think that you'd need, the rsync would need to have a view of the file structure, which you can't do if it's encrypted.
Yeah, but the rsync will be mounting two disks locally, because you would mount the encrypted disk. So on my laptop here, I would be connecting some way via SSHFS.
So you would decrypt both the master and the copy, and back up one to the other. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, and both would appear local. So I'd be rsyncing /local disk to rsync /mount/remote disk, which would then get encrypted via Lux, and then get sent over SSHFS, and the ones and zeros would get dumped onto the disk on the other side. So if somebody was sniffing the network on the other side, you've got the SSH traffic, which will go in the clear in the kernel on the Raspberry Pi. But even inside of that tunnel, the ones and zeros would still be encrypted heading down to the file system.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you see? Yes. Does anyone see the use case? Because this is as clear, obvious to me as, you know, it's full end-to-end encryption, basically, is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
No, I get where you're going to.
So that's the thing. What I'd like to be able to do is basically ship a disk to somebody, and somebody can download a default image on a Raspberry Pi, so that this is remote or syncing. So you know, your buddy, you send a disk to them, they send a disk to you, and yeah, Bob's your uncle. Okay, enough about that. The next show was playing around with text-to-speech synthesis on Linux. Playing around with different text-to-speech synthesis on Linux. Obviously, that caused no comments whatsoever. So let's move on to the next show. Basic Coproc, the future, 2009 is here. Clacky discovers Bash's Coproc keyword and explains some toy examples. There were two comments, as I strongly suspected there would be. Reading with the voice of Dave Morris is Dave Morris.
Yes. Who said, "I really enjoyed this. Thanks, Clacky. I enjoyed this a lot. Nice to be on the receiving end of the Bash info for a change." Smiley winky face. Command substitution. It's my understanding that the newer dollar open close parentheses form is an improvement on the older back tick form, largely because the substitutions can be nested. At least when I found it years ago, I was excited to be able to nest them. I assume it's nestable because the new form is easier to parse. Then Coproc subject. This seems cool, though a little involved. I'd looked briefly, but hadn't really thought about the feature. Thanks for covering it. Since Beezy and I have awoken the Orc series from its hibernation recently, I'm going to cover redirection and Orc's co-process feature as well. And episode 15 is almost ready to be recorded and uploaded. Well, it is uploaded, but not yet posted, I think. So, so there's co-processes in other places, really.
He did give us the challenge of coming up with a real-world example. And if you
my episode 15 of the Orc thing, but it's nothing very much, though. It's not that wonderful.
I think your middle name is Contrived Examples, Dave.
Why not? What's wrong with that?
Well, I actually would love to hear somebody who goes, "Yes, this is exactly the thing I need, and here's the reason I need it."
Not
meaning to criticize you in any way, obviously.
No. His challenge is a good one, though, because it's not a thing you'd want. I don't know. I can't see that many uses for it that couldn't be achieved by other means, really.
Seems to me, you know, the only reason I would see somebody doing that is some young'un comes up to a greybeard and goes, yeah, this is crap because you'll run into this edge scenario, and Greybeard pulls out CorpRock to fix that problem. And, you know, rather than rewriting a script, you put in a dirty hack to clean up some sort of edge case that could occur.
Yes, yes. I struggle to find anything.
Yeah.
As you say, I contrived an example.
Clacke says, re backquotes versus dollar paren. Yes, that's why the dollar paren was introduced. Backquotes can be nested too, but it requires escaping them with backslashes, and we don't want to go there if we can avoid it. Apart from the nesting thing, I find the dollar paren easier to read, especially when enclosed in double quotes, as it usually is. I thought that one difference between the two is that the dollar paren trims any trailing new line, but it turns out I was wrong. They both do that, so the difference is purely about quoting and readability.
Yeah, cool.
I can date my bash scripts by whether I'm using backticks or dollar paren to your episode, actually.
I hated the backtick thing. I didn't actually know in my earlier days of using bash that you could nest them, because you get yourself in a hell of a knot with it. When the dollar paren thing came along, it's such a delight. It's so obvious where one bit starts and the next ends and ends, and the next one ends, and so on. You know, you can see the nesting very, very clearly, which seemed much nicer.
So the following day, we had an interview with Martin Wimpress. Monsieur Yannick managed to track somebody down and force them into an interview. We approve of this.
I didn't have to push him too much.
Yes, those Mate people do love to talk.
Yeah, yeah.
This was great. Very, very nice. I enjoyed it very, very much. You said your first interview in English. Well, I thought it was very, very well done.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, I've got another one in the pipe, which is going to be released pretty soon, I think, with... Well, I'm not going to reveal anything, so stay tuned.
You owe me a show.
Well, I have two for you. Yeah, I have two for you. Need to edit them and submit them, but yeah, they're ready.
Excellent. The following day, Dead Earth, a review of a 20-year-old GNU free documentation licensed RPG about post-apocalyptic turmoil. Say that when you're drunk. Needless to say, it was Klaatu.
Yep, never heard of Dead Earth, but...
It's impressive that he's actually managing to resurrect this. Back to this, my notes to myself is resurrecting this from the PDFs. And it's very, very impressive that he's doing that. So, yeah, congratulations on that one.
Yeah, it's awesome. This website of theirs is actually got quite a lot of information on it. Hold on, no. I just sent my wife looking for an alarm that's going off, but it turns out it's the fan on the computer behind me is making a whoop, 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 whoop sound every so often. So I'll just go and get her back. Bear with me one moment.
Or you could let her run and then say, oh, really? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No problem.
What did I miss?
We were just sitting here thinking about silence compression, cleaning that bit up.
Yep, and then I go and root it. His show notes are absolutely excellent over there. The blog articles are the business. He really, when he does sit down to do show notes, he does show notes. I wonder maybe if we did the file print to PDF, would that fix it? And just attach them then in case they were ever gone. And actually, in saying that, that will guarantee that Klaatu will send in show notes from now on. The thought that his show notes will end up as PDF files at some time in the future.
Yes, yes. One of his non-preferred formats.
Anyway, the next day, operator sends in something completely different. IRS credit freezes and junk mail. Oh my, this is a good one. It was about, just credit freezes and stuff, and opting out of a sort of junk mail.
Yeah, the whole business of credit worthiness and credit analyses and so forth is a scary process, as far as I'm concerned. I've avoided credit as much as I possibly can in my life, so I find it to be
a repulsive concept.
Yep. However,
that's just me. My parents sort of taught us, my sister and I, to avoid buying things that we couldn't pay cash up front for, which, you know, was an appropriate thing to do post-war, but certainly not the way the world is now. But it's given me an aversion to the whole process of credit.
Well, it led to subprime mortgages and the disaster that entailed, which we're still living with.
Indeed.
So, yes, but yeah, agreed. Well, my wife has strong feelings on it as well. So, other than the mortgage,
yeah, the mortgage you can't avoid, really.
Not really, no, unless you've got, which case, yeah, you're not. You got a rich uncle or something.
If you have a ton of money to avoid mortgage, then you don't have to.
You don't have to worry about this. Yeah. Anyway, Congo Man says, credit card security. Though I hate Capital Orn commercials.
Capital One, I think that is.
Yeah, it could be. they have something new and notable. The ENO product is a credit card that gives you a new credit card reference number for each vendor you buy from. So if your credit gets stolen, you only lose the reference number, and all the other bills you pay with your credit card are unaffected. On top of that, you know which vendor compromised your credit card. That is interesting. I also think the whole way that credit cards are done, you know, the number of digits that are in there, the way you can break down a credit card, there are only a very small number of credit card numbers as such. And yeah, I don't think it's a very safe way to do transactions at all.
Yeah, I think there are companies in the UK that offer you something like this, a sort of virtual credit card type concept. I think my son has one. I've never really asked him a lot about what he's doing with it, but I think it might be offering similar sort of thing, that you can subdivide your credit card, as it were. The different reference numbers. Like I say, it's not a thing I've got into much, but the ability to partition stuff sounds like a very useful capability.
So yeah, that, exactly.
The whole thing can't be vacuumed up and stolen.
A few years back, there was a bank in France. I don't know if they still do that, but they were offering one-time credit card number. So each time you wanted to buy something online, for example, you'd first go to the bank's website and request a credit card number, which was valid, and then pay with that virtual card, and then it would not be usable anymore. So if anyhow this would be stolen, it wouldn't be useful.
Yeah, but
then you had to go to the bank site every time you want to buy something online, and I'm not sure this was really practical.
And also you run out of numbers, because there's only so many valid numbers. There's the Visa identifier, then there's the country identifier, blah, blah, blah. So the breakdown of credit card number. Yeah. Okay. yes. I see on anything that I buy now on Dutch websites or whatever, even on Chinese websites, they have the banking ideal, which is a Dutch banking thing where it just transfers you to your own banking website, and then you transfer the money directly from your bank over to that. And the beauty of that is if it goes wrong, then, you know, you can get it back from the bank.
Cool. We don't have that in Switzerland.
What? Switzerland of all places, I would expect you to have loads of things to do with money. Or is this more about getting money as opposed to giving it away?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Okay, the following day, writing a web game in Haskell, simulating at the high level. Turutoto gives an overview of assimilation in their 4X game. So far, we've been concentrating on separate pieces of the game. Now it's time to put them together in a simulation.
Yeah.
And the sample code, if you're looking at it kind of with your eyes blurry, you can kind of make out what he's doing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
You can do so many things in so little lines.
Yeah. And half of that is commons.
Yes.
I'm afraid this one passed me by because I was listening to it while I was doing something else, and it sort of skimmed over the top of my head. And I meant to go back and listen again with the notes in front of me. The notes are great, as always.
They are, yeah.
They do help a lot, but I'm afraid I didn't get around to doing that. Completely forgot. So you really got to sit down and with those notes in front of you to get it, which is not a bad thing. It's just that you need to do it. You need to actually take the steps to do it.
I do e-speak on his show notes and include those with the show. So I listen to the show notes first and then listen to the show and then I read along as he's going.
That's good. That's a good idea.
Yes, yeah. And just 5 minutes after he's finished, it's like, oh yeah, I kind of get what he's doing there. And then, and then 5 minutes later, it's all just seeped out of my head again. But that's my fault, not his. Should podcasters be pirates? Nightwise waxes nostalgic on the early days of podcasting and wonders if we all sold out. I was wondering about this. I was thinking, oh God, he's going to start playing some copyrighted music. But no, it wasn't about that. Tour de Toto says, yar, record me episodes. Now the mandatory pirate speak has been done. I can comment. There is a market for both kinds of podcasts, grassroots ones and more slick commercial ones. Latter ones won't disappear as long as there's money to be made. So it's our task to keep the more grassroots style alive. Very good.
Point, yeah. So I said tonight was memories of early podcasts and pirate radio. Not really answering his question, but just he set me off thinking.
Back in my day.
Well, you know, I've reached the age when I can drop anecdotes if I want to.
Legitimately, yes.
As I was saying to that woman on the bus the other day. Anyway, said, interesting show. I started listening to podcasts in 2005 or thereabouts. I just bought our first family PC, which is Windows. Signed up to my first ISP and started looking for stuff to listen to. I bought my first MP3 player that year, an iRiver IFP 899, and was using Juice or similar as my podcatcher. Yes, I listened to the Daily Source Code and to Dave Weiner, who's the originator of RSS, and those were some great times. I also remember pirate radio in the 1960s. I was at school in Norfolk in the east of England. We all listened to Radio Caroline, which was just off the sort of east coast of the UK, and also Radio London, which called itself Wonderful Radio London, and they were from repurposed ships off the east coast. I'd listened to Veronica, which you mentioned at times, but not a lot since it was in Dutch and the signal wasn't as good as I recall. Also good times, though. Thanks for the memories.
And did he originate RSS?
Did Dave Weiner originate RSS?
Yeah.
Did you ask?
It was Aaron Schwartz.
No, I think it was, well, there were lots of arguments about where it had come from at the time, I remember. Dave Weiner claimed to have, he and Adam Curry claimed to have come up with the idea between each other, and Dave Weiner set up a company or something where he used it, and he played around with OPML, which I think he invented as well. Though it was never formally accepted as a standard, at least that version wasn't. I thought it was the case. Certainly, I've not looked it up though to confirm that I'm right.
Interesting. There's a Wikipedia articles. Yeah, seems to be Dave Weiner. Okay.
It was UserLand that he created, wasn't it? And I'm looking at the same page as you. Should have done that earlier on. But he used to do a podcast. I think he lived in Florida, and he used to podcast as he walked along the beach and stuff like that.
Aaron Schwartz. He was also involved in the development of the web feed format RSS. Interesting. Yes, perhaps we will never know. Meanwhile, back at the show, dude named Ben says, in the voice of a Frenchman living in Switzerland.
Sorry, I was thinking about something else. Yeah, so dude named Ben says, the Podfather Adam Curry. This is a great rant, Nightwise, but you don't spend any time talking about what Adam has been up to lately, which is exactly the kind of podcast you are encouraging all of us to create and explore. From your handle, I assume you were also a knight of the No Agenda Roundtable, but you failed to even mention Adam's twice-a-week podcast done with the cranky geek himself, John C. Dvorak. You need to hit more people in the mouth about the No Agenda Show, and there's a link to dvorak.org/NA, noagendashow.com. And I have no idea what he's talking about.
Consider yourself clobbered, dude. What's the last line of that?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Missed that.
It's the in-jokes within the podcast that he is referring to.
Okay.
And actually, oddly enough, I went back to listen to some of the Today with the Techie stuff and Droops Radio, Infonomicon Radio, and RFA, and it was a lot wilder, truth be told. Like playing copyrighted music, for instance. We would never do that. We would never do that here.
Back in the days, because I also reached an age where I can say back in the days, there was no rule, it was jungle, but podcasting was, and music podcasting surely was not as paranoid, I would say, as they are now. So yeah, playing copyrighted music was not a problem back then.
Yeah, there was no way anyone was ever going to find out, you know.
Yeah,
that meant somebody physically listening to every single show and your buddy show that had three listeners, including your mom.
Exactly.
You know, who was ever going to find out about it? And yep. Now with the search algorithms that, yeah, you can ban, and the law has changed with the DMCA as well, that you get thrown off the internet and you get lawsuits taken against you. You know, the whole world has changed legally.
Back then, you were hosting your own MP3s and RSS, so there was no real central directory. Nowadays, as soon as you start your podcast, it has to be on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, sorry, and Google Podcasts, and all the major podcast hosts, and they apply, or if they don't, copyright holders do look for podcasts on those platforms, and they scan the podcast, and then they know exactly where to look, for music.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I'm not even talking about Spotify and those. Hosts, the podcast host wannabes, you know,
yep.
they should probably stick to their original business model and leave us alone. That's my rant. Sorry.
Cool. The following day, we had building an Arduino programmer, turn an Arduino Nano into a programmer. And this is a related show to one of the shows that I did. And this is basically taking my crappy idea and doing something pretty cool with it. I like it.
So you can explain something to me.
I can.
What's the advantage of using another microcontroller to be used as a programmer for a microcontroller, as opposed to just, you know, using the bootloader and loading the Arduino sketch directly?
You can get it's been a while since I've looked at it, so bluffing, as you do. You can get rid of the bootloader entirely, I believe, and just put your code on there. No, it could be bullshit, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's what I understood, but I just wanted to be sure.
But this would also be just useful in that you have a dedicated machine to use as a boot, to copy the bootloader onto the other machines. You don't need to set up one. It's permanently fixed for you.
Hmm.
And the reason I had to use it in the first place was there was no bootloader on the chips that came. So I got them without any bootloader. So I had to put a bootloader on.
Okay.
And the only way to do that then was either you had a you basically went through this procedure. You used another either a dedicated bootloader for or a dedicated thing to burn the code onto the Arduinos, or you used another Arduino as a host. And in this case, he's just sacrificing a Arduino to do that.
Okay. How big is a bootloader on those things? How much space do you gain by getting rid of the bootloader?
I do not know.
Because it seems to me that it's kind of lots of work to just gain a few, you know, tens of bytes or hundreds of bytes, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, if it's a lot bigger, then maybe it's worth it.
Yeah. But as I said, the reason I did it in the first place is that there was no bootloader on there. So they hadn't shipped anything. So you're screwed. Or if it gets corrupt for any reason, then you might want to update it. Okay. So a new version comes in. Why would you change your BIOS? It's kind of the same idea, I guess.
Okay. Got it. Thanks.
And whoever is screaming at the microphone right now can just press record and send in the show. I am file it under Ken is Wrong series, which is increasing by the day. The following day we had...
I thought you were right, by the way. That was what I would have said. Not knowing less about it than you do, but that seemed to me to be the right answer.
I just, with electronics, I'm just so dipping my toe into the water, and I'm now... Well, if you're listening along to this HBR episode, I envisage somebody on night shift somewhere having started listening to all the shows. And if you had, can you please fill in the tags, by which time it's too late by the time you get to this one? But if, for example, you're downloading this show because you've got hours and hours and hours of boredom ahead of you, and you're going back to the back catalogue, please fill in the tags for Dave. He'll be eternally happy, admittedly. Yay. You need to wait about 3 or 4 years of night shifts before you'll be able to hear him thank you for it. But okay. where was I going with this?
I don't know. To episode 200 and 2800, maybe.
Okay, let's do that. My YouTube subscription, Sergeant Pepper channel. This is a hookah. Sid Meier's Civilization, 60 Symbols, Smarter Every Day, Space Frontier Foundation, Streaming Freedom. Dave, help me out there.
I think that's Irish.
Yeah.
Nah.
That's what he said in the podcast anyway.
That's what he thought. That's what Hooker thinks it is.
Shivna? Yeah. Done. Okay, Shivna then. And I defy anybody to contradict me. Talk More Talk, The Beatles, The Economist, The Extraordinary Universe, The Great War, The Planetary Society, The Sexy Gamer, The Total Trailer Life, DIY Veritasium, Vintage Space, and Vlog Brothers. Unless he's got a lot of Zeds, I think that's the end of it.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yes, that's definitely the last one. Good, some good stuff, though. Some good stuff.
Yeah, I'm subscribed to quite a few of these as well. Not the Beatles, obviously. Well, not obviously, but now obviously. The following day, my guitar set up part and the pictures for the episode are on a remote location that may or may not go away. We will never know.
Well, yes, this also concerned me. I have to say, I look at these every time NYBill sends them in and think, oh, what should we do? What should we do?
I weep a little.
We need to do something.
I think we need to contact the mailing list about this, Dave, and everybody will go, there are only two people on this mailing list who gives a crap about this. not true, because I know Jason Scott is on there, and I know he does give a crap about archiving stuff.
Oh, if anybody would
give a crap about it would be him, sure.
Well, I like this episode, and I look forward to the fact that it's part one, and there will be more of this to come. Then, The Midlife Assessment by Plaque. And this was, it seems life goes faster and faster and turns around and goes slower and slower. And this was an interesting episode. I found myself wondering how I was going to respond on this show to this episode. So I'm just going to chicken out and say, Dave, what did you think of this episode?
I also was not sure exactly how to respond. I said, Clack is turned 40 and is ruminating about the next 40 possible years of his life. Good luck. And
that's not meant in a nasty way, but you know, it's he's probably right that those 80 years are quite likely for somebody of his age, if he is lucky, and a fair number more perhaps, so long as the anti-science movements in the world don't say, now all this age research is to go down the drain, it's stupid, why would anybody do that, and so on and so on and so on. But I don't see the business of things going quickly and slowly so much from where I sit. So I'm about 10 years away from that end point. So you know, it looks different from where I am. Things are going fairly quickly, faster than I'd like, let's say. But it depends where you are in the scale of things, I think.
Well, my view was he's described a fairly idyllic sort of bell curve for what somebody's life is could be. But yeah, it only takes one tiny little thing to throw a spanner in the works. And I would not wish that on anyone, touching wood. Very unscientific and non-skeptical thing to do, but hey. I hope his plan goes according to plan. But my own experience has been life delivers you the unexpected from time to time.
Yeah, yeah. Having seen people around me who are looking forward to a fair number of more years of life, and then they don't arrive, but the opposite does. It's a gamble. It's a big old gamble. You just do everything you possibly can to make sure that the stakes are good as far as you're concerned. And
The best thing you can do is send in all your shows now, and then we'll make sure they're on the Internet Archive, which we will make sure gets rocketed into space before the planet is annihilated, so that your essence will be maintained for eons to come.
Absolutely. Wow. Yes.
And if that's not a reason to do a show, then I don't know what it is.
Yeah, we can contact SpaceX and put the whole HPR archive on the next SpaceX mission.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we sent a Tesla into space. I mean, we could, there's plenty of space in the boot. Trunk for the US listeners. And at the risk of just to prevent Dave blowing a fuse, I'm not going to read the next one because that will be going into next month, and then that would be more scripting that you would need to do on the show notes.
The pain that you saved me is, thank you so much.
So, missed comments from last month. Note to volunteers in a big red box. You should really leave these in, Dave. Don't go back and edit it. Just leave
it. No.
These comments are for the last show. We're not read at the last show because they arrived after the recording. This section will be removed before the notes are released.
That sounds like a Mission Impossible message, you know. Good evening, right, volunteers.
It's fading as I watch it. It's going. Now, what happens if we record inside the month that we're reviewing? Then you can get comments that occur in that month, but could potentially not be read. That was the thing that bothered me. And these things really gnaw away at my brain. So I sort of wake up in the middle of the night thinking, I must solve this. And everybody's pointing and laughing, going, you silly old sod. But I still have to solve it somehow or other.
And then the thing is, this one has got one comment that was posted last month, so should have been discussed in the last one show. And now another one that's going to be in, that's been posted in this month, which obviously we'll do together. So, so anyway, okay. Hipster says, enjoyed it, great, sounded great. And for those of you wondering what it was that he was commenting on was the Alden P, HTTP, IPFS, and torrents, replacing the web with a new decentralized protocol. And IPFS is Interplanetary File System and Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And he says, thanks for the podcast. I learned a lot. These protocols are fascinating because to the end user, a few bytes here or there seem to be insignificant. But across the entire network, a few bytes here and there can add up to millions of dollars. Oh, the audio is great.
Yeah, all those pictures of cats, actually. Yeah, that cost a lot.
Exactly.
And they take a lot of bandwidth.
And Tlake says, although he said it at the last comment from Dave's thingy, that the audio quality, take it from somebody who records shows on their mobile phone, your audio quality is great. Meanwhile, Dave is in editing the show notes to say this has already been read. I hate you, Fallon. I hate you.
It's because I'm striving for perfection in a chaotic world.
Yeah,
and it's the story of my life.
The next comment was on getting ready for my new MacBook Pro, and it was from Bart. Aren't you forgetting a hub? You have a cable and a case, but you need a USB-C Docker hub to connect your old stuff. You can get them from various websites. USB-C adapters.nl. Okay.
Okay. That's going back into January 2018 at the show he was commenting on, which is fairly unusual.
Yeah, I remember that show. I remember all the shows. like my little children.
The next one was on one of my shows. So
go for it.
2739 Bash Tips number 19. Clacke says, local. More on what local variables are and how they work in episode 2807. So he's doing a look forward to next week, which is good. Thank you very much.
And then Clacke commented on Alden P's episode 2774, CGDNS and Yggdrasil. And the comment is titled Yggdrasil Pronunciation. As a Scandinavian, I can say that your pronunciation of Yggdrasil is entirely accurate. And if anyone doubts it, they can hear Hugo Weaving pronounce it in much the same way in Captain America, The First Adventure, which by coincidence I saw only a few days later. So I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, actually.
Because we all know American movie houses take so much effort to get accents right.
Exactly, yeah.
But isn't Hugo Weaving Australian or something? I think he's an Antipodean fellow, so he's going to have an entirely different approach to Yggdrasil.
Well, I suggest Alden P. sends us in the show proving why we're wrong.
And explaining in great length how to pronounce Yggdrasil.
It's always been pronounced that way in my world, because it's that Linux version, isn't it, that they're talking about there? So anyway, whatever.
So shall we deal with the mailing thread, which has been a smidgen busy this month? Ooh, gosh. Okay. Whew. Yeah, exactly. HPR LLC. This is fascinating how, people commenting on it. I think we should probably just leave those. It was needless to say an April Fool's joke that I sent around a... Did I send it on the day? Where is the original?
Send it on the, April 1st.
Why is it not on the list, Dave?
Maybe the day before.
That's an interesting thing. I don't know.
No, actually, you didn't send a message. The first message was from Nigel.
Yeah,
it was a response to the episode. So you just chimed in later, I think.
No, I sent the.
You did?
Yeah, I sense they, as you know, HBR has a long-term history of providing quality technical content over the years. And then basically,
I think something's got confused about times in this, because the thread is all sort of back to front. I'm not sure where your, if you look at the thread view, where your original message. Yeah, it's not seen as being in on April 1st for some reason or other. Is that because the server is in a different time zone and it's not being adjusted somehow?
Yeah, it could be. Although my if you look in the comments, so I replied to one on April 1st, 2019 at 5:25 p.m. NZDT, New Zealand date and time. Strange. Anyway, doesn't matter. We'll figure it out. Basically, at the end of last month's show, Dave was off sick, and then we announced that Dave was leaving the project because I was accepting a financial reward for doing the show, and that we were going to do... start monetizing HPR basically, and HPR LLC and stuff. But all jokes aside, we do get quite a lot of these things regularly. I think once or twice a month we get somebody contacting us about how we can improve our advertising opportunities, blah blah blah.
Oh yeah. Is that what
gave you the idea?
Yeah. You're just kind of sick of them. And also, basically, people ranting on about, oh, the podcast, I need you guys to support. If only one person sent me $1, and then I would blah. Well, you just do it. And then if people send you money, good and well. But we know ourselves, just from getting somebody to contribute, that you're lucky if you get 1% of your people actively engaged. And for the rest... Yeah, I'm really with Lost in Bronx on this. You put on your shows and you give it out there. If somebody, and as I said in my reply here to this, if somebody wants to take HPR and monetize it, nary a problem here. No problem whatsoever. It's all released under the Creative Commons licenses. And so long as you adhere to the licenses, no problem. In fact, I've set up a special, the feeds are there, so you should be able to take the stuff and... If there's anything that we can do to make it easier for you to do that in the future, then let us know. We're not going to make it more difficult. It's about spreading the message. Yes, I know that it's like down to the GPL debate or versus the MIT license. Which is more free? But yes, if you do want to give money to HPR, go give it to Josh or go give it to archive.org, josh@anonymoustoast.com. Better yet, sign up for one of Josh's plans. You do get excellent service, I know, as somebody on the receiving end here on HPR. But yes, there were some good, some interesting reactions from people about it. And I saw cultural differences with the way April Fool is treated. So there you go.
As to answer the question of where's my email, it's actually in the March, your original email is in the March archive thread, because the mailman system is running on PST and PDT over the DST change. So I did not know that. I'm not sure how you can tell mailman to use blooming UTC, but... probably you can't, but I don't know.
And there's some other ones. Mike Ray's reply is in there, and Clarky's one.
Yep. There's a whole collection of things that are deemed to have been in March rather than in April, including Lost in Bronx saying, "I don't like this day of the year."
I completely agree with
him. I like that one the best, to be honest, because it's a never been my favorite day.
Oh, what other stuff were we talking about? Static site generator is not a flat file CMS. So that one was, probably wasn't clear enough either of what I wanted. And what's for HPR, we generally have a lot of static files. So you got the website and you produce a show, like, and then the show has some comments or no comments or some comments. And then after 6 months, it's still being downloaded, but it's not going to change. So the number of physical things on the website itself as a whole that changes during the day are the RSS feeds, the main website, the series links, but the episodes themselves remain pretty static. So what I wanted to do, as I explained earlier, was be able to dump it into from the database into a flat file system, and then have that rsynced and SSH about that. So the database that's on the website, the HPR website, I eventually want to get rid of and only use it for, don't panic, Dave, don't panic, take deep breaths, breathe in, breathe out. The one on the website running on the active PHP, so that would only ever be triggered when somebody sends in a comment or somebody sends in a comment or a show, something like that. And even then we might be able to get rid of that, but right now limited to the reservations table and the comments table, or actually reservations table, because the comments doesn't even hit the table at that point. And then when those files hit, that would trigger back-end processing, which would be available on the HPR GitHub repository, but due to the sensitive nature of it, that would be taken and then run through the processing servers. And then at the end of that, that would spit out a flat file, the flat file changes that are needed on the various different shows. So if somebody sends in a comment, that will go to a JSON file using PHP, be saved, be picked up by some cron system that will go get imported into Dave's database. Yeah, Dave?
Yep.
And then some flat file CMS thing would take the database fields and map them to dollar, you know, placeholders in HTML templates that will get populated and sent out. And then this thing would know, oh, this episode has been updated. This episode 21 or whatever has been updated with a new comment. So I need to rewrite that episode. So that way tonight, then when you go home and you do your rsync, it'll pull down today's show, but it'll also pull down episode 21 because there was a new comment to that episode and you've got that text file as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
So I've got lots and lots of good feedback on that. If you have recommendations for that, please send them in as well. And what else? Yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm focusing a little bit on the elimination of PHP on the website. The reason we have PHP is that we use variables for if somebody goes to Hacker Public Radio and that's blocked by your firewall, then you go to Hobby Public Radio. But I saw that we could actually do that with Apache. So if we were running a website that has got a HTML file that says Hacker Public Radio, there's a module that you can load into Apache that will just change any particular word or instances of word. So rather than having to rewrite separate instance for that Hobby Public Radio, it will just simply read Hacker and then display Hobby to the consuming system, and everybody would be happy. Make sense?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So with that in mind, I was looking at some templating system, how we could combine templates and stuff, and how we could do some things with CSS, and how we could include menus and include various different pages and stuff. So I'm just going to see how all that goes, because what I don't want to do is, if we make a change to one of the menus, which is in the header file, that will trigger every single page that is on the HBR website to be re-downloaded in the source sync. So I want to try and do that slightly elegantly if I can. I don't know how yet, but we'll see. But more information will be coming, and it will the information is on gitlab.anonesthost.com. You can mosey over there and see how we're doing. There has been a proposed change to the upload form, and so now the tags and explicit tags are not set, but they are flagged as mandatory. And Jason S. Dodd replied, "I don't mind the tags. At the same time, I don't find them kind of useless unless the tags themselves are curated so that I get a list to choose from and I don't have to create new ones all the time. I typically find that searching the whole post gives me better results when I'm looking for something, but don't let that stop you for requiring at least one tag." As I said before, these tags are more intended as being something that will allow you to commit your show to a ongoing internet campaign or other. So for example, if we're doing a show on OddCamp, we can do hashtag OddCamp and then have that appear in general searches for OddCamp.
And the tags are also propagated through to archive.org. Yep. Where they have a really nice search interface to find stuff.
And the tags, well, I don't want to prompt the tags rather than having to use JavaScript and backend database, etc. is that it would allow cross content to be discovered on archive.org. So if you are thinking about using tags, then you should equally think about using tags that are on archive.org. So for example, using the Apollo computer one that we did, that you would tag it Apollo mission or whatever, that would be on archive.org, and then they would pick those two up in the search. It's just a by the by. And he put in comment, remove default explicit tag from form, but didn't say what he wanted done. Oh yeah, there was some weird things with the SGV files. Jeroen wanted to print off the HPR logo and it didn't open for him. It opened for me and some other people. So I'll go through all the, in this refresh of the entire website, I'll go through those files and make sure that they all open. I'll probably bug Klaatu for that, as he's Mr. SGV.
SVG.
That's the one. Thank you. Okay. Error and comment. This is related to text-to-speech and the episode that Jeroen did on text-to-speech. And basically, it can be summarized to this. eSpeak's author, Jonathan Duddington, in my humble opinion, deserves a Nobel Prize. So, and I don't think anyone is contradicting him there on that. Kirk Reiser notably commented, eSpeak, saying eSpeak is great, and I would really love to hear with an interview with Jonathan. Unless I miss my hunch, he may no longer be with us. I haven't heard anything about him from him in years, so the emphasis is on eSpeak-NG. I'd like to be wrong on that front. Yes, I'm sure we all agree. And to which Mike put us in the loop with regard to who Kirk is. A non-insignificant contributor to text-to-speech and access text for the blind and VI users on Linux. Anything else to say about those threads?
No,
I don't have anything.
And Jeroen commented on this, this episode again, saying it wasn't intended to be in any way an attack on eSpeak. It was just evaluating programs with regard to HPR intro text. And I've just submitted a show as well with two other ones that I found. So with a few other ones that I found. So we'll have a look like that. HPR by request. Anyone want to do this? Or oh yeah, Jeroen sent decided to get into podcasting in a big way and sent us a link of the stuff that he was getting. And Yannick is right in there asking for some episodes and the stuff that he's done.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you cannot show pictures of really nice hardware without doing a review for HPR, can you?
Not at all. Not at all. I really did like his SVG, scalable vector graphic. Yeah, SVG. The SVG logo that he did on the polo shirt. It's quite cool.
Yeah, yeah. I think we should each have one for Hogcamp.
Somebody want to mention Hogcamp? I am so excited.
Yeah, so Hogcamp, 29th and 20th of October.
Actually, hold on one second, because there's even better. There's better to come.
Ooh, better.
Hold on one second. Lost in Bronx was talking about the mics. Yeah, and he needs to do a show, basically. He's talking too much. He needs to do a show. Okay, Jeroen did mention, Jeroen, as you know, is Dutch, and I live in the Netherlands, and he happened to be around where I worked, so we went out for dinner one evening. And in the course of that conversation, he mentioned that LWN.net has a community calendar, which I had no idea about. And he said that on the community calendar, Hogcamp was happening. Over to you, Yannick.
So, Hogcamp. Hogcamp, it's going to be the 10th anniversary of Hogcamp on the 19th and 20th of October in Manchester, in the United Kingdom, probably in Europe.
it's possibly Europe, yes.
Possibly. It's an unconference, so it's really nice. It's a 2-day event. Really, for me, I went to my first Hogcamp last year, and I'm really looking forward to go back this year. It's a way to put the faces on voices and names that I hear about during the year. I made lots of friends last year, and I did have the chance to meet with Dev last year at a camp.
Yes, indeed.
Which is actually what drove me to HPR. So yeah, the event starts on the 18th on the Friday evening with a social event. And I think really, if you want to come to Hogcamp, that's the good way to start with the first pub event, and then there will be an official track with the talks. The CFP is open, so you can submit talks idea to Hogcamp, and then there's usually a corridor track, which is something that people put their ideas for unscheduled talks on a whiteboard, and then talks get voted, and the most popular talks have a room and an hour or something like that. And they were also talking about reinstating the flash talk. I think that's how lightning talk. Yeah, so lightning talks are like 5 to 10 minutes talk. And it's a great way, I think, to give a talk if you don't know how to give a talk, or if you're scared or something like that. And I'm going to make one. So look out for that and run away.
Cool. Very cool.
Yeah, so I was just on Hogcamp website. The CFP is open, so hogcamp.org if you want to submit a talk to the committee.
And I contacted LWN.net and asked them for their permission to use their calendar, basically, and they said straight away, no problem, go ahead. That's why it's there. So we could technically go through some of this stuff that's going to be coming up in May or possibly June. What would you reckon, Dave? How would you do this? Well, the Open Infrastructure Summit is already over. in Vienna. Latchup 2019 PyCon is going to be on from now until next Thursday. The OSDC is going to be on the week after that, from the 14th and 15th. OS Camp is on the 16th. BSD CAN is on the 17th to the 18th. Saturday the 18th, Linux Wochen Linz 2019 is on, as is OSC Albania. Those continue on for the entire weekend of the 18th to the 20th. Then CanCon and KubeCon, Cloud Native Con, are both on the week of the 20th to the 24th. OSC starts on the 24th and continues over the weekend. Mini DevCon starts on Saturday the 25th in Marseille and continues to the 26th. On the 28th is PreCon Live Open Source Database Conference in Austin, Texas. And that continues the 29th and the 30th. Then the Libre Graphics meeting in Saarbrücken in Germany is on from the 29th to the 31st.
And after that?
And after that. DevOps Days Toronto is on the 29th and the 30th. And PGCon Ottawa, Canada is on the... Has that been going on? No, that's on the Thursday to the Friday.
Yeah.
Should we come
to June? Lots of conference.
June, Libre Graphics in Saarbrücken, Germany. Libre Graphics meeting. Samba XP is going on in Göttingen in Germany. UK OpenMP Users Conference is on in Edinburgh. This is on all in June. Maybe Mini DevCon is on in Hamburg. Southeast Linux Fest is on in Charlotte, NC in USA on the 14th.
North Carolina.
Yep, North Carolina. Southeast Linux Fest is on in... did I just cover that? Yes, I did.
Yep.
What did I miss? Hong Kong Open Source Conference is on the 14th and the 15th. Tlaki is probably at that. And on the 24th, we have KubeCon, Cloud Native Con, Open Source Summit in Shanghai, China. You can actually tell from this, the ones that are from Monday to Thursday tend to be the business ones, and the ones at the weekends are the community events.
Yeah, clearly.
So that's pretty cool. They even have a call for papers deadline calendar up this week. Does anyone want to do that? Tell us if this is boring. Linux Developer Conference is up this week. Pi Colorado's up. Conference for open source users and promoters in Taipei, Thailand. EuroPython is DebConf is going to be in Brazil. Is calling for papers is ending. Call for papers for EuroPython 2019 is up this month. GNOME User Developer Conference in Greece is up this month. LPC, Linux Plumbers Conference in Portugal is up, as is the last two, Academy in 2019 in Milan, Italy, if you're a KDE person, and the Linux Security Summit in San Diego. That is it.
That is a lot of conferences.
Yes, but it's nice to have it on one page, and it's a great service that LWN has put on. I've contacted them about doing an interview, so hopefully that'll be coming up in the future.
You owe yourself a show.
I do indeed. You have no idea how many shows I owe myself. But that's a good addition. And then finally, not finally, tags and summaries, Dave, because I need something to drink.
Well, there are two things in the other business. One is the draft of an HPR article on Wikipedia, which anybody who is a host can't contribute to.
Yep.
So we're looking for anybody who is not a host yet to assist and hopefully then afterwards become a host. So I think I don't know what else to say about that one particularly. Have a look at it and see what can be contributed. One of the things about Wikipedia is that they always want citations and so, that sort of thing. So
yeah,
I'm not sure exactly what's involved in doing that for some of the things there. But
So to that end, I have been going back listening to HPR episodes, Today with a Techie episodes, and Radio Freak America episodes, LinuxLink.net episodes, to see what the history was about when it started and how it got involved and what the original plans were. So I'm making links to that for the talk section of that webpage so that other Wikipedias can review it and decide yes or no whether this is valid or not. And I'm transcribing snippets of text so that you get a feel for what the conversation is, including links to directly to the audio where those shows discuss it. And I will also be putting in links to places where we've been in the media before as well, in that talk section, as I will be trawling the interview section to find links to people who have Wikipedia pages, so that we can link back to those people.
Good idea. Yes, yeah. Yes.
And particularly, we should also try and get people who we have discussed projects with, that the, for example, you see the Hacker Public Radio interview is linked on the Slackware page as when we were talking to Vonkerdink, what's his name?
Patrick Vonkerdink.
That's linked back as a reference to Hacker Public Radio, and that will be a nice way to reinforce the eligibility of HPR being a web page. Generally, it should be, because you know there are loads of pages about things, a lot less imposing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Or a lot less, that have a lot less impact. I mean, we're one of the longest running podcasts in the world, full stop. End of story. You know, we have the number of hours of content that we have available, the whole approach to the way podcasting is done. We've been reviewed in several articles and stuff. So yeah, it's no harm. And it's also a way to get people into HPR. I also want them to take from my name out of the draft, because I don't think it adds anything to it. It's better just to say it's maintained by volunteers, and here's how you can become a volunteer. So I'm not doing this for an ego thing. I think that when you say, oh, I'm part of Hacker Public Radio, and then people can go to Wikipedia and see, ah, these are not weird, you know, these are, yeah, hacker is a name we struggle with, but having a good Wikipedia presence and a good archive.org presence gives a certain veritas. Is that the word, Dave, I'm looking for?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Reputation that, yeah, these people are hackers in the sense of contributing in the way that Wikipedia does and archive.org does. So, there you go.
We're the good hackers, the one with the white hat.
Sometimes. Not all of our shows have been like that. There have been interviews with black hats, black hats as well, but that's as with all walks of life, we are an unrestricted platform for discussing. We're the wild, wild west. Yay. Here be pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Dave, tags.
The tags and summaries, I want to highlight the fact that Tony Hughes was our contributor for this past.
The man.
He was, I forget now exactly how we came to discuss this, but he said, ooh, what do you have to do tags and summaries? And I pointed him to the page, and he said, ooh, I'll have a go. And he got the bit between his teeth and did 36 of them.
Good man. 3 points for him.
Thank you very much, Tony. That was very, very good. It's moved us on a goodly bit. And being incredibly lazy, I didn't actually do any in this past month. So these are all down to Tony.
That's excellent. Chipping away at these is brilliant, actually.
Yeah.
And Odd Camp, we're all officially going to Odd Camp, even Jeroen.
Yeah, it's coming back. It was there last year. We'll be back with Miss Jeroen.
Cool. Excellent. I am looking forward to that.
And you will be there too.
Yes, don't ruin it for me.
And Tony Hughes will be there because he said to see you at Odd Camp.
Of course.
Of course, yes.
Yes, the quickening. Okay, cool. Tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of Hacker
Public
Radio.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers. You'll be free.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.